Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is editor at Mobile Nations, Russell Holley. Well, Russell, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited about having you on the show because I've been reading up on you, and you are an expert on some things that we here at the Mac Observer are not an expert on. And I can't wait to hear your perspectives on some of the things we have planned to talk about. So this is going to be really cool. For the listeners, you are contributing and managing editor at Android Central under the Mobile Nations family. Formerly, you were with Geek.com. And over the years, you've become an Android expert with the focus on mobility, smartphones, of course, tablets. And you're also well-versed in iOS. And you also write about augmented reality, all things that are not in my expertise. So let's dig in and tell me about growing up and how you got into tech.
Oh, absolutely. So this started for me, this kind of lifelong obsession started as a young child. When I was 9, I received my first computer as a Christmas present, and I had never had anything like that before. My parents, owned a computer, but very rarely used it, and it wasn't something that that I was allowed to touch as a child. And so I wanted to learn every single thing that I possibly could about this machine. It was a simple Windows 3.1 machine, and within 2 or 3 months, I had learned every single command. I had, you know, just become completely familiar with this. I had become so familiar that when the family member who gifted it to me took it back for a repair, or said it was a repair, I actually noticed that he had installed drivers for a CD-ROM that he then gave me as a next Christmas present. So that was how familiar I was with my system, that at the time, just the act of installing a new driver was something new that I noticed very shortly after he returned it.
How old were you at this point?
I was 9, yeah.
Oh, my. Most of us were still playing with blocks when we were 9.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very exciting experience, and it wasn't something that I had ever had a whole lot of access to. Especially in school, there just wasn't a whole lot of technology in the classroom yet, especially in the area that I was living, which was rural Pennsylvania. So it was a very new experience, and I just wanted to know everything about it. And I've carried that particular mindset forward since then.
Was there a succession of personal computers after that?
Oh, very much so. Yes, I moved from that computer to a larger system that I had built myself 2 or 3 years later. And when I started, becoming more mobile, spending more time with friends and going to schools that were a little farther away, I became more interested in portable machines, as portable as laptops were in 1990. So there's there was a shift there to portable machines for a while, and really just, how much computing could be done with what we then considered mobile devices, and just kind of grew from there.
Now, in the years past, mobile PC notebooks, because they had LCD displays, were pretty darn expensive. Tell me about that, and tell me how you avoided falling into the Macintosh world.
Well, it wasn't a conscious decision on my choice, but it was on my parents' choice. I did not know this at the time, but they had my mother in particular had kind of an aversion to Mac computers. She had had a negative experience early on in her career with machines that just didn't quite cooperate with her workflow. Time and so didn't want to bring that experience at home. The Windows was the only thing that she had used in her work environment that she was comfortable with, and so wanted to bring that experience home instead of something that she wouldn't be able to troubleshoot or diagnose in any way. But it wasn't until much later that I realized that was a conscious decision on my parents' part and not something that that I had chosen.
Tell me about your Windows laptops.
They started with Windows 98. One was a gateway machine, and the biggest reason that I bought it at the time was the CD-ROM drive could be removed and replaced with another battery, which meant that with two batteries in it, my laptop could get me a whopping 4 hours on a single charge. It was either playing games or doing work in classrooms. But I, I had a heavy duty leather backpack that had a protective inner coating that the laptop would fit in, and altogether weighed something like 11.5 pounds, that I just brought with me everywhere. Anytime I left the house, I had that backpack on.
We tend to think of laptops of the past the way we think of them now, with giant, thin 15-inch screens. But I bet this one had maybe like a 7-inch screen or something like that, like the early PowerBooks.
Yeah, I think this was close to a 9-inch screen with a great big bezel all the way around it. And I moved from that machine to Toshiba Satellite, which was at the time, you know, one of the most kind of thin profile machines. And it was the first machine that I had actually bought with my own money. And it was, you know, that was the goal there was, you know, since I was always going to be carrying this thing with me, I wanted it to be light and still have, you know, enough battery to get me through what I consider to be a day at the time.
Did you take one of those to college?
I did. Yes. I took that with me to school and actually, never really got rid of most of my older machines. I would repurpose them for other things at home. My first laptop for a very long time, when I had a constant internet connection, a non-dial-up internet connection, as it were, was a local server that I used for media that I could access from, you know, from any of the computers in my home, or as a kind of backup computer when a friend came over and wanted to play games with me. So we had kind of a local network connection for things like Command and Conquer and games of that nature.
Did your passion for computer technology carry into the academic work you did in college? Were you a computer science guy?
Yes, I was a computer sciences major. I moved very quickly into networking and low-level systems engineering. I was deeply fascinated by how the network was built. I spent probably an unhealthy amount of time assembling my own RJ45 cables. just because they were something simple that I could do, and a large group of my friends appreciated that I could make them considerably faster than they could.
Now, I'm curious about something. When one gets into computer science at a university, one is usually immersed into a Unix environment of some kind or another, but you were a Windows person. Did you go with the flow in Unix, or did you somehow sidestep it?
This school that I was at, University of Maryland, was largely a Windows facility by the time I had gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were Unix based systems there, but it was our experience there from a classroom perspective was more from a command line perspective. It was more learning, using that as a window for learning commands for server administration and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not to familiarize ourselves with the Unix environment or the Mac environment.
Now, normally one as a computer science major in college, in my experience, tends to think about going to work for, you know, some glorious company that you like, you know, like IBM or Microsoft or something like that. Tell me about that. Was that the path you had sought to take? Because we don't normally think about being a technical journalist at this point.
No. Being a technical journalist was actually an accident. I started out very much interested in server administration. I worked for several companies as server administrator and help desk support mm-hmm. and things like that.
Yeah.
For some smaller companies, and then I went to work for Comcast as kind of an educator. I went and my job there was among, you know, kind of call center things, was also to help train people when new versions of operating systems came out and how kind of the underlying systems for the Comcast infrastructure worked, so that they had they were more better able to troubleshoot, you know, when calls came in. And there was a massive snowstorm that I ended up traveling to
this
work.
This was in Philadelphia, right?
This was in Maryland. I had moved to Maryland at the time. But there was a big snowstorm that I had ended up traveling to work in one day, and actually fell and did a considerable amount of damage to my right arm, and wasn't able to type for almost 2 years as a recoverative process. And through that, I wasn't my workers' comp situation was such that I wasn't working in the office. I was working from home, and they decided Comcast decided to kind of part ways with me. And so while I was recovering and going through that process at home, I just to keep my mind busy, I was using voice to type programs, Dragon Naturally Speaking.
Oh yeah.
To just kind of share my thoughts to no one in particular, about the things that were happening in the tech world at the time. And this was during the early days of the OpenMoco headsets or handsets, and just before the T-Mobile G1 launched with Android. And so this was, you know, kind of a very formulative space. The iPhone was brand new, and there was just so much happening in the world of mobile technology. And I developed a small audience of people who really appreciated the stuff that I was saying, and went from there to I was approached by PC Magazine and Geek.com, who are both part of the same parent company now, to write for them about this. And so it quite literally became an accidental journey into tech journalism.
Interesting. That's one of those classic cases of one door closing and another door opening in a fantastic
it really was.
Way. Yeah. So you worked for Geek.com. That's where I first knew about you. And that was until what, 2014?
Yeah, I worked for Geek.com for the majority of the time from 2000 to 2014. And through them was published several times in PC Magazine for coverage on things like Google Glass and kind of advanced forms of technology that I had spent time with.
Were you one of those people who was fortunate enough to try a pair out?
I was. I actually still have my set. It sits on a shelf because I dare not put it on anymore.
I want to talk to you about Google Glass in the context of augmented reality in the second segment of the show. So let's just keep that on the shelf as well. So then you fell in with Mobile Nations. That's quite a group. I first found out about that through Serenity Caldwell and Renee Ritchie. I didn't realize that there was this glorious parent company, umbrella over some family of websites. Tell me a little bit about Mobile Nations, what it's like working for them.
Yeah, so Mobile Nations is a great group of people who all have their own individual focus. So we have fantastic people like Renee and Serenity over at iMore and the team at Android Central with Daniel Bader and Andrew Martinick and some of the others over at Windows Central with Daniel Rubino and Jez Corden. But there was no one who really operated across all of those sites. And that kind of accidentally also became my job, because I, at Geek.com, I didn't have a particular silo to work in. Whatever the new thing was, I kind of took it and learned as much as I could about it and passed it on to work on the next thing. And so I had this, I developed this background in how the iPad worked with things and how Windows machines worked with all of these things. And then, obviously my focus on Android phones continued to grow because it was, there was a new Android phone almost every week for a while there. And it just, came to be that I just had this familiarity with all of these different forms of technology. And so when I came to Mobile Nations, it was very natural for me to contribute to each one of these sites, almost equally.
Do you guys work out of a virtual office? Because there's a fantastic team photo of you guys at the Mobile Nations website. And I was wondering whether you all work at home or whether there is a glorious office where you tend to congregate around the water cooler and geek out with each other.
As much as I think most of us would love to have an actual central office where we all got to see each other every day and collaborate on things, we are virtual for 99.9% of the things that we do. That photo was the result of the first effort to bring all of us together in one space to kind of plan out the next generation of our company.
Ah, yeah. We did that at Mac Observer. We had a summer camp a few years ago and got together in person and had a great time. Well, that's a great story to hear, and I thanks for sharing your progression and your happy landing in the technical journalism world. In the second segment of the show, I've got some geeky questions I've been dying to ask you, but first, we have to take a short commercial break. Folks, we'll be back after this short message in 60 seconds. Stay with us. I'm chatting with Russell Holly.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks. I'm chatting with Russell Hawley from Mobile Nation and Android Central. Since I have an Android expert on the show, I know you know a lot about phones, iPhones and iOS, but I'm dying to ask you a bunch of questions about Android that those of us in the Apple world are kind of ignorant about. So how would you characterize the current day difference in terms of the fundamental difference between the iOS and Android and the pros and the cons?
Sure. I mean, the biggest difference in using these phones every day, and you know, to be clear, you know, I use an iPhone 10 every day when I'm able to, and I switch back and forth between that and my Google Pixel 2 and have for months now. Mm-hmm. And I really have to say that the biggest difference between the two of them is it comes down to integration. You know, on my Android phone, if I have something that I want to very quickly share from one app to another, say I have an email that I've gotten that has a file in it, I want to very quickly put that file in Slack so that I can share with a coworker. The number of steps that I go through to do that are very short. It's you know, three taps to make that happen, and it's in Slack for someone to see.
So no sandboxing.
Right. There's no sandboxing there. And Apple, you know, and rightly so in some cases, has a sandbox created such that you download a file and you close that app and then you open another app and you upload that file. And as long as everything is set up there, then you know, that process still goes fairly smoothly. There are just a few more buttons in the way. The other thing is notifications. You know, Apple's notifications have grown pretty considerably over the last couple of years, but the default mechanism for notifications is any app that has a notification, unless you tell it otherwise, will present on the home screen, and on your lock screen they kind of disappear after you've seen them. And then they're you know, kind of available later if you want to call them up. Android phones operate a little differently in that the notifications are kind of always persistent across that top bar until you choose to either access them or dismiss them. And when you do choose to act on them, there are just this massive host of options for interacting with those notifications inside the notification tray without having to open up that application.
Sounds like it can be a little bit overwhelming and a little irritating. Maybe.
It can, yeah. In both situations, I think what it really comes down to in both the iPhone world and the Android world is kind of noise control. You know, the signal to noise ratio when it comes to notifications for any phone right now can become deafening. And you just have so much information coming at you, regardless of which manufacturer you're operating with right now, because a lot of applications are, you know, they're just set to kind of constantly feed you notifications for things. But I will say that over the last year, Apple and Google both have done a pretty good job of making sure that there are tools there so that you can go in and make some conscious choices about what's able to send you notifications and you know, for what. But you know, in my daily use, they both kind of feel like half measures right now. I hope that we see more notification controls for users here in the future.
I think we'd like to be able to talk to a smarter AI and teach it about what our preferences are, rather than having to figure out how to dive into the machine and the settings and twiddle with this and touch that and try to gain control in a mechanical way over our notifications. Yeah, that's my dream. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a cool thing. I think the only counter there is, you know, is making sure that you're comfortable with that AI having the ability to see what's in that notification to begin with in order to make that decision for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why they call it intelligence. So what's the latest version of Android? I've lost track of all the code names.
Sure. The latest version of Android is 8.0. Its code name is Oreo. All of the Android versions are named after tasty treats and desserts of some kind. Mm-hmm. So it's Oreo is the most recent
version. Is that shipping version now?
That is shipping now. Yeah, that's been out since October last year.
Okay. Another thing we hear about on the Apple side is horrendous security snafus on the part of Android, and fragmentation, meaning that people who've bought older phones can't get their carrier to update to the latest version, or the phone is not capable of it. And so people are stuck with older phones that are fragmented and can't get the latest operating system with the latest security measures. Is that a correct perception on the part of the Apple community?
Yes and no. Yes, there is definitely a problem where a lot of Android phones do not receive what are considered the kind of core operating system updates nearly as fast as an iPhone. You know, the Apple releases an update and day one, it's available to every iPhone, iPad, iPod user. They can install an update right then and there. The same is not true for Android. That having been said, there's an internal set of software components that Google updates far more frequently than anything else. And this handles, base security infrastructure, app security, and a lot of the kind of inner functions for how you interact with
So you're saying that even if I'm running Jelly Bean, for example, there are some over-the-air updates that fix the guts for me?
Correct. Yeah, the core operating system features are separate from these kind of internal security features. And those security features are updated much faster and don't actually require user input to install them. They are installed as part of the Google Play Store, essentially. So when the Google Play Store updates, and Google's version of the App Store, when it updates, those security features come in with it. And those features are very different. So it is half right that the software fragmentation for Android is a serious problem when it comes to updates, because there are still a lot of really cool things that come with the core operating system updates, especially like we were just talking about, things like notification controls, our core system updates that some of these users will not get for months, and in even a few more of those users may never see.
A couple of years ago, I reviewed an Amazon Fire Phone, and if you turned off one of the most obnoxious features that gave it a bad rep, it was actually not a bad phone, but one of the things I noticed was that it wanted to use software encryption. It didn't have a hardware chip, and as a result, the software encryption was so tedious and took so long that you tended to want to leave it off. Tell me about Pixel and other modern Android phones. Do they have anything like hardware chip encryption and the secure enclave that the iPhone is famous for?
It's not exactly the same. There is a hardware element as part of ARM chips, especially over the last year. It's called the Trusted Execution Environment, mm-hmm. And it is in functional terms very similar to Secure Enclave, in that it is a physical component that encryption keys can pass through, and those encryption keys cannot be extracted by someone who just picks up my phone to extract those keys and then extract the secure information that comes off of it. What's different there is that it's obviously not on every phone. It's something that manufacturers have only had access to on Android phones for really the last year or so. And Google's encryption efforts on a software level have been kind of adjusted to match that. So the speed issue, the performance issue that you noted on the Fire Phone, on something like the Google Pixel or the Pixel 2 or the Samsung Galaxy S9, that doesn't exist anymore. That problem has been replaced by this TEE system that is similar in nature to the Secure Enclave. But it's still a relatively new thing for Android phones compared to the iPhone, which has had Secure Enclave for, I think, four generations now, if memory serves. So it's very different.
Is it a good strategy then would you say, because Android phones tend to be less expensive, is it a good strategy to update your Android phone often to take advantage of these changes?
It's certainly an advantage to do so if you're interested in those latest features. You know, the advantage to the security feature here obviously is less of a day-to-day security and more of a theft perspective. If someone takes my phone and tries to wipe it and install their own account on it so that they then have this phone that they can use, then this trusted environment stops that from happening because it doesn't have my encryption keys in order to access that information. And you know, smartphone theft has been just kind of this massive rampaging thing across the world for a long time now. So that's good. But it's still not, you know, you're still going to run into the same problem if you buy the next $200 phone. The company that makes that $200 phone isn't quite as incentivized to push those updates as you know, someone who's making the $800 phone.
Yeah, we've filled this in on some really fascinating features of Android that I don't think most of the listeners, and I certainly didn't know about. This is very cool. You told me before the show that Android community is torn about, the Android fans are torn about the notch. I thought that was hilarious. I see the notch as on the iPhone X we're talking about. It's just an array of sensors and a convenient collection. And I imagine that it's possible to distribute those sensors in different ways, in different places on the phone. But is there a notch envy? Is that what you were driving at?
No. I just think it's funny that there's this same conversation happening on kind of both sides of this operating system, setup there. I know, you know, probably just as many iPhone users who are happy with their iPhone 8s because they don't like the kind of visual effect that they get on the iPhone 10 with this cutout. And, you know, the essential phone was an Android phone that came out with this kind of bezel-free display with a notch up top before the iPhone X was even announced. And so I wouldn't say that it's an envy thing so much as this was the direction the industry was headed, and it's just going to be that way for a little while until these sensors can be embedded behind the display, I think.
Yeah. It doesn't bother me very much. It just sort of sinks into invisibility for me. I have an iPhone X as well, and it's not really an issue for me. I don't notice it.
So. It's not a day-to-day concern of mine, but I will admit to being frustrated when I watch videos in full screen, which isn't often on my phone because I have a tablet if I'm really sitting down and watching something on an airplane or something like that. But yeah, if I open something on YouTube and turn the phone to watch it, I still notice it. But in most of my day-to-day use, it is pretty invisible.
Let's move on to tablets here real quickly. Just want to ask you a couple questions. The iOS came out for the phone first in 2007. And then it was glommed onto the iPad in 2010. And there is this vague feeling in the Apple community that Apple didn't really tailor iOS to the larger screen of the iPad. And so you have this giant, stupid array of icons that works very nicely on a 5-inch phone, but maybe isn't optimum for a 12-inch tablet. And then there's this concept of limiting a Unix operating system to one login user in iOS on the iPads. How is Android thriving or not on the tablet community? Does Android make a better transition? Is Android different in good ways or not at all when it appears on tablets?
There are some ideas that Google has had with Android tablets that I really appreciate. Some of them you already named, having multiple users on a single device, having better support for the desktop, if you will, interface, where you have a little more flexibility over what information can be there so that it's not just an array of giant icons. Mm-hmm. There is some strength there, but no Android tablet has ever really caught on. They don't sell very well regardless of the manufacturer.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Most people that I know personally who have Android tablets, they got them because they came free with the phone that they got from the carrier. they got this phone.
TV set.
Right. Yeah. So it's, this is I don't know anybody that I can think of right now, aside from people who own the latest of Google's products. Just because I don't know anyone who has on purpose gone out and bought an Android tablet because they wanted that to be their next computer.
If they were in their right mind, right?
Right. It's just not a thing that I see happening. And Google has if you take a look at Google's product lineup over the last 2 years, they very clearly have moved away from Android tablets and onto Chromebooks of running Android apps. You know, that's the direction that Google's
questioning.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. My vague knowledge of this is that there was a Chrome Web OS that you ran on Chromebooks, and that recently Google made it possible to run Android apps on Chrome OS. Did I get that right?
Mostly, yeah. Chrome started as you know, kind of a web-only system that was really just the browser. You know, the very first version of it 4 years ago was just the web browser. It didn't even have a proper desktop interface. You just had, you know, tabs in a browser, and that was it. Over the last couple of years, it evolved to more of the kind of that traditional computer feel, where it has a desktop and you know, you have window control like you would on a Mac or a Windows machine.
Can you access local storage, like insert an SD card or flash drive?
Yep. All of those things are possible. You can, you know, almost every Chromebook has a full size SD card slot for expansion, and there are multiple USB ports. A lot of the new ones have USB Type-C built in and use that for charging. So they have been, over the last couple of years, they've transformed to be fairly modern computers that function very well offline as well. But the original version of it, the one that I think most people who don't use Chrome OS on a regular basis are familiar with, that kind of original version, which was this kind of almost like a dumb terminal.
Yeah.
If you remember terminals from 15 years ago.
DT100. Oh,
yeah,
yes.
It's, you know,
dating myself.
It felt very much like that in the early days of Chrome OS.
Can you use Chrome OS nowadays to go to Google Play and download an Android app? And are there any restrictions? And can you pretty much run any Android app now?
You have access to the Google Play Store. The Google Play Store is an app that launches just like any other program that you would have on the computer, and it gives you this interface to scroll through and install. It is not a one-to-one comparison between Chrome OS and Android phones as far as what apps are available. Developers have to choose to support Chrome OS, and so there are lots of applications in this store. But not every app, because developers have to choose for this interface to be supported. You know, a lot of Chromebooks are traditional mouse and trackpad systems that don't fold over into tablet mode or anything like that. And so you have to think about that kind of logically. There are a ton of apps where the touch input would be very different from a mouse input. And then developers kind of have to choose to support that, and lots have, but in many cases that ends up being a problem. Now, the most recent versions of Chrome OS devices over the last 2 years, a lot of them have this kind of two-in-one mode where they fold over on themselves and have a touch screen so that you can use them just like a tablet. And so a lot of those, don't have that kind of varied limitation on interface. You can just kind of reach out and tap them just like you would any other tablet. And we know that while not yet, several manufacturers have announced Chrome OS devices that are just tablets that can have keyboards that dock into them later, similar to the iPad Pro and the Surface.
Why did Google do this? Was it because they wanted to enhance the capability of Chrome OS in the education environment, or they just wanted to create a new outlet for their Android apps? What was the motivation?
I'm sure it's a little of both. Chrome OS has seen its highest point of growth by far in the education space. A lot of these are inexpensive devices that schools can and do pick up by the dozens and interface, with all of these different environments. And the Android app ecosystem has a tremendous amount of education apps, just like any other platform of this nature. There's just a ton of education programs built in. And so being able to offer, students and teachers that additional, expanse of applications separate from what's available on the web is a tremendous opportunity. But also for personal users, having this kind of ultra light laptop that gets 2 days of battery and also gives me access to a mobile version of Lightroom, just for the stuff that I do, is incredibly valuable. To have this almost a throwaway computer, for lack of a better term, that I can do fairly serious photo editing on, is impressive.
And we've heard rumors that Apple has picked up on that with Secret Project Marzipan, that apparently will allow you to run some iOS apps on your Macintosh at some point.
So I'm eager to see.
Yeah,
I'm eager to see that. I'm also. I hope that that comes in coordination with some form of touch support on Macs for that, because I think that you run into the same problem that early Chromebooks did, in that, you know, touch interfaces and mouse interfaces are just not the same. And I have wanted a MacBook with touch support for as long as the iPad has existed.
Yeah, you're not alone.
I would be very excited to see that. Really, I think I would be very excited for an iPad that just ran macOS, but I know that that is challenging in other ways.
Well, we're about running out of time. I can't believe how fast this went, but I can't leave the show, and the listeners would be upset at me if I didn't ask a couple questions at the end here about augmented reality. I see that you've written a lot about Oculus Rift. I don't know a lot about augmented reality, and so tell me about Oculus Rift real quickly, where it's going, what the prospects are, what you think the prospects are for an Oculus Rift to someday look like Google Glass in terms of size and weight.
Sure. I mean, Oculus Rift is a fully occlusive headset. You know, you put your head in and the entire world disappears, and it's more virtual reality than augmented reality, in that it replaces your full sphere of vision with something else. And it's largely an entertainment device right now. You know, it is fantastic for certain forms of gaming and immersion, you know, being able to kind of experience like you are physically in another place, and you can, you know, move around in that space and feel like you're actually moving around in that environment. It's very entertaining.
And how much does one of these cost?
They started about $400. Mm-hmm. to connect to. Unfortunately, not a lot of Mac support for them yet. But we do know that that's something that is planned for the not so distant future. So I'm pretty hopeful there. But the biggest thing about the difference there between an Oculus Rift and an augmented reality headset is you know, being able to see through the device versus being able to be fully immersed in it.
Right.
And I would love a device that we wore like Google Glass that offered, augmented reality like we have on the iPhone X. You know, I think that would be a really amazing thing. And I have to say, Google Glass was first announced, if memory serves, 6 years ago at this point. And
wow,
we still have nothing like it. There's, you know, nothing that even came close to competing with it as far as, list of available features and just kind of doing things with it. And I think, any company who is interested in augmented reality sees that as kind of the end game, is making a set of glasses that you can put on that can create these visual effects to kind of enhance the world around you. And I'm very eager to see that happen. But I think we're still quite a number of years away from that.
As a follower of the technology, you must have some sort of feel for the progression. Is, as you said, maybe 5 years till we get there. So I think a lot of people feel right now that this is a really geeky thing to do, and they're waiting for it not to be so heavy on their heads and limited capability. So
the closest thing we have to something that I would say is a viable consumer product when it comes to either virtual or augmented reality is actually not Oculus Rift. It's the more recently released Oculus Go, which is a fully enclosed headset, not augmented reality, but it's actually a standalone headset in that it doesn't require a computer that you connect it to. It doesn't require a phone that you connect it to. Ah. It's a $200 headset that is its own computer that you can, you know, bring with you anywhere. And it's fascinating. It is very much like having an entertainment center. And as awkward as this sounds, an entertainment center that you strap to your face.
I'm going to have to try that out one of these days. It sounds like it's affordable. All right. Well, we really are out of time right now. I want to thank you for sharing some interesting notes about Android and Chrome OS with us, things that I'm betting the listeners didn't know about. And I'm really glad to ask you about. So thank you for sharing that with me.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Tell the listeners how they can contact you in the best way.
I am at Russell Holly on pretty much everything, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those things. Russell Holly on iMore and Android Central and Windows Central. I'm pretty easy to track down with my first and last name.
Okay, great. And we'll put some of these links in the show notes so people can learn more about augmented reality. So thanks again. It was really great having you on the show, and it was nice to get to know you.
Great. Thank you.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.